I have been told that I must inform you the following program contains adult subject matter, adult language, and spoilers. Now thank you and enter if you dare.
Sergeant Boland's first round got Tra Huang through the neck. Round two was through right temple of village chief. Round three through back of Colonel Huang's aide, unidentified. Departed station B at approximately 0652 hours. All objectives accomplished. Arrived base camp at 0940 hours. No casualties. Sniper team able. Vietnam represented a new type of warfare for the American soldier. Many grim specialties were developed there by American youth, and perhaps none more grim nor more specialized than the one personified in Sergeant Mac Bolin. Bolin had been a career soldier. At age 30, he was a 12-year veteran and on his second Vietnam tour.
Executioner in the books, there's only been a movie or two that touched on that book series. But The Executioner was a series of books where, especially in the beginning, you had to subscribe to get them. They were a kind of rag that some people called pocketbooks or pocket novels. We had the term, it was the same term used for newspapers, rag. And I'm sure at one time they were also dime novels. You know, that was one of the things about them. They were cheap. They would fit the man's back pocket like a wallet. A lot of kids read them. If you had the money for the subscription, you'd get the subscription and they'd come in the mail. I knew kids that got things like Playboys that way. They didn't steal them from their daddy because they wouldn't sell them to you. In fact, I can remember in the 70s, you had to show ID to buy a penthouse. Don Pendleton wrote this series, and it was long. It had a lot of spinoffs from it, too. Most of them, in the beginning, Don Pendleton supposedly wrote. But they ran from about the late 1968 all the way, I think, to something like 89 or 92. I can't remember. So they had a long run. And you can still buy. I don't know why anybody would do it. I buy them used. I go to a half-price books or something and get one for $1.70 or something, you know, that's used. But if you want new printings of them, you can get them anywhere from like $7, $15, and you can get a new printing of them. They are a lot like comic books.
Yeah, that's actually what got my attention when it came to The Executioner. Was I was a kid, I want to say it was in the early 80s, and every now and again, it wasn't in supermarkets. I think I'd see them in like maybe convenience stores, and I don't even think chain convenience stores. I think it'd be like places where there's like mom and pop type of places. Mm-hmm. But I'd occasionally see one of those Executioners racked up, and I think they were probably by the books, because I would check out magazines, comics, books, anything that was words on paper I was going to look at as a kid if I could access it, right? If I could get a hold of the Nerd Nudie mags, I'd love to look at them too. I remember like my mother would occasionally buy these bawdy books of just the cartoons, like the kind of cartoons they'd have in Playboy and such.
Yeah.
It would be a whole book just of those, and she'd pick those up sometimes. But anyway, usually closer to the porn than to the comic books would be those men's adventure or action.
Oh, yeah, they would be where the guns and ammo, mm-hmm, and porno and all. Yeah, because they were meant for men.
And so besides the fact that you have a provocative name like The Executioner, and there would always be some kind of explosion or somebody handling a weapon or something, also the thing that grabbed my attention was the numbering. The fact that these books had number 87, number 93, you know, it's like, so it looked like a comic book. And I did a little research on it, and they basically are. I mean, it's the guy in
this. Yeah, they don't have any pictures.
Yeah.
Some of the later ones had pictures of a weapon.
Right. But the idea of this, I've talked previously about exploitation. And like, you know, things that you make not because it's for the art, but things you make for the intention of provoking the response of the reader. Stuff where it's like you're essentially manufacturing something on demand for these people for what they want. They want action, they want adventure, they want to get the
executioner makes James Bond look like a Boy Scout.
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially in print.
And by the same token, 007 makes the executioner look like a Boy Scout. The executioner has much more scruples than 007 does. Either in the books or the movie, he has more scruples.
Well, I understand that his nickname when he was in the Vietnam War was Sergeant Mercy because he would literally doctor people. Yeah.
Both the name executioner and the name of Sergeant Mercy was attached to him in Vietnam. The reason why is he was an executioner. He was a sniper. He was behind the lines operative. He might snipe his target. He might use a garrote. He might use a knife. Or he just might just beat him to death if he had to.
But basically a U.S. military stealth assassin.
Right. He was a sergeant. He wasn't a Green Beret. I think he was an Army Ranger. He was attached, but he was attached to what they called an able team. But most of the time, he worked by himself because he had to move fast, get in, get out, and they didn't, for stuff like that, they don't want to risk a lot of guys. It's better. But on his way back, a lot of times, because he was a very moral person, if he saw and he didn't care whether they were enemy or not enemy, if they were kids and women in need, he'd drag them back to a field hospital where he had friends that would take care of them. And that's where the Sergeant Mercy came in. I guess it was his way of karma. And as they progressed for a long period, and that was one of the things that I noticed about the books. Pendleton's style was, it was like he'd get bored about trying to make up stuff that would happen, the action stuff. He was producing, I mean, these books came out like one every month or something. Mm-hmm. And so make it easier to produce, he spent a lot of time with the Mark Bowen character thinking. And he would think in different ways. He would be thinking all this philosophy. I guess I'd call it, if Pendleton didn't use the term, I'll use it. Because Pendleton liked to, Bowen lived in hell. When he had to do something, he was in the hell brain. He used those terms a lot. So this was philosophy of the hell brain. And he also had all these retrospective thoughts. On one hand, Pendleton would write that he left his past behind it. Well, if that was true, why would Pendleton spend 4 or 5 or 10 pages in every book going over what's happened before?
Right. Well, and like Ian Fleming, Pendleton was a soldier. I think he was decorated, and he'd actually lived this stuff, and you have to assume there's a little bit of an author insert in the
executioner as well. I think he was a chain smoker too, because every picture I ever seen with him, he's got a cigarette in his mouth.
Pendleton?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the weird little parallel there. Like, Pendleton claimed to have invented the, I think, action-adventure genre, and from what you're telling me, since the Bond books aren't necessarily in that genre, maybe that was correct? Like, it seems to me, from what I know of the executioner, he has more in common with the James Bond movies than the James Bond books. And you're telling me that the books are much more like a John Le Carre kind of thing as opposed to the big spectacles we're used to. So was the executioner James Bond before James Bond was James Bond?
I don't see how that you could say that, because I don't know when Pendleton actually started writing the books, but the earliest one, I think, was late 1968.
Okay, so he had to be presumably influenced by Bond then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last time I read the book that I'm about to talk about that was an executioner book was 56 years ago.
You haven't told us how you were exposed to the executioner. And given that you're going back 60 years.
My father's family lived, and we've talked about this some, talking about other things. My father's family lived right across the river from New Orleans. Still today, when I start talking about Orleans, I start talking like they talk. Because when I was a kid, we'd travel every summer to see the relatives, and they all were in different places, but especially the ones in Orleans, they had the thick accent, which I always thought was funny because most of them were born in Florida, but that doesn't really matter. They were born in Florida and Mississippi and ended up in Knowles. But I'd hang with my cousins. We'd go on the bayou. They like to go around the bayou with a shotgun and shoot turtles. You know, the turtles was their target, but they'd shoot anything else they saw.
Did they eat the turtles or just shoot them?
No, they just shot them.
And I assume they pierced the shell.
Huh?
I assume it pierced the shell, right? Like when
if you've got, I think the shotgun had about 26-inch barrel on it. It was a double barrel. If you're 50 feet away from the turtle when you shoot it, you can shoot the turtle a bunch of times. One of the games they would play is see how far they can move the turtle with the shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
So the first shot would be like 50 feet away. And of course, the shotgun is only going to be effective for so long to get something like this that's attached to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just, they'd see a tortoise too, but a lot of them were painted turtles. That's another thing. A tortoise is easier to hit, but a painted turtle, its whole design is kind of like a tank. So, you it may take you a while to get the right range on it, It's not as simple as it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, my cousins did a lot of things like we talked about before, going around hunting people and that sort of thing. I did not participate.
No questions on that one. I don't want the answers to any of that.
Right. Okay. So, well, the funny thing is, they were always the ones that got shot up.
Oh, yeah. they went looking for trouble and found it, huh?
Yeah, but you're talking about kids, man.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about kids. I was the next oldest.
Yeah.
My cousin, this gets to what you were asking about. He was 16, okay? When he was 16, I was the next oldest, and I think I was 13 and a half. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
He was also different than us because he didn't have it all together. He wasn't exactly, let's just say he was slow. But still, his parents got him a driver's license, and he had a car at 16. So you can imagine, I'm 13 and a half, the next one's my next cousin. See, I don't want to mention their names, although they're funny in and of themselves.
Yeah.
The next one down is a year and a half my junior.
Mm-hmm.
And then his brother is like 3 years his junior. We would all be together, We'd be our own little squad in the summertime, although the oldest one wasn't around all the time. But when he was around, we were together. And also, you can imagine living real close to the river too, what it was like in the summertime as far as the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousins, the older one, what it is two sisters that live side by side. In their house, they always had and used air conditioning. In the other house, they didn't. They had screens and maybe a fan in the window. So you can imagine what it was like in Owens right on the river in the middle of the summer.
Yeah.
So whenever we would sleep on a pallet at their house for their
right.
And if I remember right, they had a TV and the other ones didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Not until they didn't have a TV till like the 70s or so.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were a group. The other cousins, they all were merchant marines or shrimpers. Either way, they were known to poach.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised between two worlds. Antebellum Southern world that didn't have the issues you would think from that. And they respected all people is what I'm saying. And then...
Antebellum definitely doesn't mean that anymore.
Huh?
Antebellum nowadays is very much plantations and all that kind of stuff.
But that's what I'm talking about. If you had been to the family homestead in Houston, it looked like a plantation. It was a big white colonial house. Really big. Two-story, but because it was pier and beam, the second story was three-story. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You had to dress properly. Women dressed in white wore white shoes at a certain time. The women always wore gloves when they left the house. It was all
Southern ladies and gentlemen.
With a British flair. They had when I was a kid, they had a German shepherd. The German shepherd's name was Trinka, and they had this cat, and the cat's name is Jackie, and you can guess why it was named Jackie. Because this is...
I pictured you walking around with a little pillbox hat on.
What?
You said I could guess why it was named Jackie.
The name of the cat was Jackie after Jackie Kennedy.
Right, and I'm talking about the cat having a little pillbox hat on.
Well, I would have said white heels and gloves. The house had a carriage house, which was a garage, a laundry room. They had two big freezers in there.
Yeah.
Then the top was my oldest great aunt. She lived in the carriage house above. And yeah, it was very antebellum. All these oak trees with moss hanging off of them. We even had between us and the neighbor, because it was a huge piece of property. I think it was like 12 acres or something. The next piece of property over, the next neighbor over, would have been from back door to back door about two neighborhood blocks. And you had to go through a cane forest. There was a time in Houston where you saw bamboo quite a bit. And they had a bamboo forest that was like a wall between them and the next property.
Mm-hmm.
I know I played in it all the time. If you wanted to find frogs and insects, go to the bamboo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the things about Vietnam, you know. I grew up in that kind of atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a safe atmosphere. But as far as the snakes and all that, from the time I was little bitty, I was living like that. But
well, I mean, I was in Vietnam reading up on it and, you know, just the things you encounter while you're there. A lot of people immigrated from South Vietnam to Houston specifically because they didn't want to be someplace where it was going to be too cold. They wanted to be a place that was hospitable to what they were used to, which is very humid, and that's what Houston is. And so I know I grew up and there was a ton of Vietnamese immigrants in my neighborhood. It was just what I grew up around and what I'm used to. And to this day, Houston has a large, not only Vietnamese, but also a large Asian population.
Well, when you were there, did the weather seem comparable?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, comparable, not comfortable.
Yeah. Now, Cambodia is way more humid than here, but Thailand and Vietnam were
probably. Fortunately, I was not in Cambodia.
Yeah. Oh, Cambodia, I was sweating like Elvis.
I wasn't in. In fact, I was in two places in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and that was Da Nang and Quang Tri. It might not have been pleasant, but it wasn't Cambodia.
Yeah, it was interesting because when we went to Vietnam, my girlfriend didn't want to do South Vietnam. She thought it was too westernized, but I wanted to do something in Da Nang, and I did not realize how important Da Nang was until later on, since that was basically where we come in. Like the U.S. forces, that was your first stop. You were in Da Nang and then you might carry on from there, but you landed in Da Nang. So I didn't realize. I heard the name in movies, you know, growing up, there were all those Vietnam movies. You took me to some.
Mm-hmm.
And Da Nang always came up, but I never realized what the significance of it was.
Mm-hmm. There's virtually anybody that's been to Houston and Da Nang. No, there's no significant difference in the weather. It's hot and humid and oppressive in the summertime.
We're the Bayou City. You know, that's the Bayou State. So it makes sense. But you were talking about getting exposed to the books from your cousins.
He had a bunch of mail order books. We were talking about the Sergeant Fury books,
mm-hmm.
and whether they were Sergeant Nick Fury.
I'm assuming not. I'm assuming that just you happen to have two things.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
It was too long ago. But when I was there, I would read his books.
Yeah.
And
he said they're mail order too. Did they not have like periodicals accessible out there, or was it just he wanted stuff that wasn't available?
These books, we were talking about the executioner, all these books you ordered.
Yeah.
People didn't want to. The grocery stores didn't want them on their shelves. You have it when they appeared on a news shelf. They appeared. You don't see newsstands like you used to, but you would have big newsstands that would sell all kinds of stuff. I know that in parts of Houston they still have them, but it's mostly for pornography.
Well, they definitely have the porno newsstands, but there are a few like international magazine stores.
Yeah, I think there's.
I don't know if there's still. Actually, it's been a few.
The best one that Houston ever had, I think, is still downtown.
Okay,
it's right. It's easy to get to. They sell, you know, maps and all kinds of travel information, but they have all the newspapers and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's like 7-Elevens and stuff would have Playboys, but they'd be behind the counter because mm-hmm. you had to show ID or get them.
And I remember behind the counter with cigarettes would be your adult magazine.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you wouldn't see these books there. You know, even though they sold paperbacks and they sold pocket novels. Those kind wouldn't be there. You had to mail order. Mm-hmm. And then just like comic books, they have all kinds of gizmos and crap.
Yeah.
I was reading one last night that had, you know, one of these, in the 80s, you could pick them up at a gas station. It was a digital watch. And I can remember when you could buy them for a dollar or $2 in a shopping rob. Mm-hmm. And they had it like it was some kind of fancy gizmo.
Right.
And you were going to be able to get it through their book, you know. You had to unpeel the grenade and put it on the next page and fill it out and send in your money. Just like the back of a comic book.
Right. Yeah. So I'm guessing with your cousin, what it was, at some point got exposed at one of these truck stops.
He was a single child, and he was mentally kind of slow.
Yeah.
So if he wanted to read something, I'm sure my aunt and uncle was more than happy to see to it he got it.
Yeah.
So, but we wouldn't have been exposed to it. But no, I didn't. I had to read stuff like that when I was around where it was around. And the only place it was around was in my cousin's bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
But I know his was all mail order.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that they lived in a town called, back in those days, I understand it's different, that these people got pushed out,
mm-hmm.
and now it's kind of a
hoity-toity,
hipster, whatever you want to call it. But back then, it was a white supremacist town.
Mm.
You know, they may not have been in a white supremacist group, but, you know.
Sundown town.
They didn't use that term, but they said the line, you might come in the daytime, but you better be gone before sundown.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I understood what it meant. I just didn't understand why they would be in that town to begin with.
Right.
Yeah. I never did. I never saw
them. Well, as you said, they were party to some of that.
Well, so. They weren't the kind of people to have servants. Nobody in that town was.
Yeah.
But the town's name was... And it was right across the river from Nala. From what I understand, what's the name of that town? It seems to me the name of the town is Pendleton or something like that. Like, and it's quite a distance away, but that's where a lot of them moved. But see, most of those people, I think I have one of them, maybe two of them that are still alive, even though they were younger than me. They all succumbed to one thing or another, and it was never, you know, a natural death.
Right, yeah.
Well, I mean, other than the older ones died of natural death. But getting back to the executioner, he comes home from Vietnam on emergency leave. His mother and sister and father are all dead, and it was a murder-suicide. His brother, one of his brothers, the youngest one, he got away because he was with an aunt or something at the time. But it was all caused by his father had to take a loan. And this mafia family...
Yeah, I think he had a disability or something. Like, he got injured or something on the job and wasn't making any money and needed a loan.
That sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, he borrows the money and then he can't pay it back. And the mafia turns his daughter into a prostitute. Anyway, Matt Bowen comes home on emergency leave to bury him.
Yeah, because dad had found out and shot the mom and the sister and himself.
He comes home to bury him, and then he finds out what happened. So he declares war on the mafia.
Yeah. I understand he broke into a rifle store or some sort of sporting goods store, put together a small arsenal, left an envelope of money to pay for it, because like you said, he's an ethical guy. He just couldn't wait until the place was open the next day to get him some guns to start shooting some
people. Well, he didn't want it traceable either.
Yeah.
After that, he was going to just take care of that one thing until he realized, see, he didn't really understand the mafia. And by going after this one family, he became aware of what the mafia was. So he decided it was a calling.
Yeah.
He declared war on the entire mafia system.
So it hadn't occurred to me. That means he went AWOL then.
He did.
Okay. And see, he was already in like a second tour in Nam or something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, top marks, good soap, well-liked, and people helped him because of that. You know, I mean, he had generals that loved him, doctors that loved him, everybody loved him.
So he basically has a broad support system for his vigilante crusade.
As time went on, he had this very broad support system. But he financed his war by taking their money.
Yeah.
He might destroy all the dope, but the money went home with it. It became known as one of his, you know, every time he had a campaign, he would invent a new war chest. You know, he might use the weapons he come across, but he didn't really keep them. He always bought the weapons he wanted, right, whatever he wanted. But he used their money, so they paid for their own destruction.
And this is clearly a successful series because it goes on, and then it starts having spinoffs.
Yeah, I'm not sure. See, I haven't read any of the spinoffs. Mm-hmm. And I know what they're about because if you read The Executioner, you know what they're about. All the spinoffs are references in The Executioner book. I don't care how many spinoffs there were, but they can't have the number of books The Executioner did. I know that I read a book 493, and it certainly wasn't the last one. So I don't know. I haven't looked up the number.
Well, you were telling me last night, and I did a little research, is apparently Pendleton was doing the books up until like 1980 or so. And you were telling me that toward the end there, he was getting a little, he was running out of gas, clearly.
It was sometime during the 80s. You start seeing people added to his line. You know, like it would say Don Pendleton and so-and-so. And you really see it in the spinoffs, seeing it on the shelf. So I know most of the spinoffs have somebody else's name tattooed to it. As far as I know, most of the characters in those spinoffs you'll find in the Executioner books, because it all comes from the Mac Bowen character and his history and all that stuff.
Well, my understanding is he was a vigilante. He basically ran out of mafia at some point. Like, he killed so many of them or dispatched them so thoroughly.
He actually wasn't out of them because he couldn't destroy the, because it comes up in the books all the time. You know, you lop off one head and another one pops up. Mm-hmm. He really severely damages the
organized crime.
The organized crime, and not just their links in America, but their links in Europe.
Okay? Yeah, he actually was fighting through international mafia.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, because they had attachments. What was it? You went to Italy or France or whatever it was, and to do one thing, and that led him into Italy, France, and London, Marseille. But by then, the people that were hunting, so you got to remember, it wasn't just the mafia hunting, the federal government was hunting, not to mention all the
state and local authorities.
The state and local authorities, because, I mean, this guy laid waste everywhere he went. He was more like the Avengers when they had town. He did that kind of damage. He just do it when nobody was on the street. No innocents got killed.
He always had to make sure he didn't hurt any civilians.
Civilians. And if something happened to him by some flung, you know, crazy thing, you know, like say the mafia really damaged somebody and he saved, well, they just might find a suitcase with $500,000 sitting next to him to help them get along through life. That's how he operate. It was all mafia money, you know. Yeah. So the whole idea is bad people do bad things and good people do good things, even when they're doing bad things to bad people.
And then I understand that done as much damage as he could to the mafia, then he started going after terrorists, and at some point he looked up the U.S. government to do that, right?
Putting the cart before the horse. He got the notice of some serious threat. And of course, you think about it, you got a guy doing that kind of stuff in the open, making the news almost every night. See, that's the other thing about him. Just like it is, if you're reading a 007 book, this stuff is taking a period of time. Mm-hmm. In the movies, it's one day, 2 days, maybe 3 days.
Right.
When in the book, you...
A month
at a time. You know, every once in a while it might be 3 weeks or something, but it's a reasonable amount of time to do that much damage.
Right.
In the Pendleton books, oh, hell no. No. You'll read the whole novel. One of the things about him is, you know, you see it in movies a lot, synchronizing watches and all that stuff. If you're an organized combat squad, you have to do stuff like that so you know where everybody's at, because you can't see them all the time.
Right.
And if you have a coordinated attack, you have to do that. Well, somebody like Bowen that would be something that in his military service he had to use all the time. And he's always talking about the numbers. So his life is by the number. Everything in it is by the number. But the difference with him is he can do more than 007 ever thought about doing. And he could do what 007 did in a movie in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it took you to watch that movie,
he's already done it.
He's done it. It don't matter if it took 007 2 days to do it. Mac Bowen did it in 2 freaking hours, and he was late when he got finished. And if you think I'm joking, read one of the books. Just grab one off a used bookshelf sometime and read it. Mm-hmm. You'll be lucky. Sometimes you would open, especially the older one, you'd open the book and it would start and he pulled the trigger and the brain splashed across the wall. The gray matter sliding down the chin, dripping off the shoulder like a waterfall.
They didn't need you yet. You were dropped into the midst of everything.
Yeah. And that's the other thing about Mac Bowen. He loves headshots. That's his main thing. And every time he takes one, they got to give you some kind of gory description of it. I don't know how many times you can juggle brain matter and skull. In one book I read, the skull looked like an ostrich egg full of blood. You know? The gray matter splattered on the wall. You know, crap like that. He likes mentioning the third eye. Mm-hmm. He opened the third eye and took half the nose. Then for good measure, he put one in his chest. Yeah, Mac Bowen wastes a lot of ammo. He usually, when he shoots you in the head, he shoots you 3 times. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many of them I've read. You know, his third shot missed because there was nothing left to hit.
Well, you're telling me how unreasonable that is last night, the other night.
It's all unreasonable, you bet. And maybe, I was thinking we'd go to the range because if we go to the club tomorrow, the weather's not supposed to be so bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, so good. It doesn't really matter that people this time of year really aren't using the pistol range. But we don't want a lot of people around when we're using my gun. So we go out there, we try a couple of my biometric chatter guns,
mm-hmm.
and we record it. Yeah. And then you can put it in one of the things.
Yeah, we can do that. Because I can take the laptop out there, and I just like this, it'll have its battery power, and it should run the microphone. So, yeah, we can do that.
Well, and there's power out there if we need it.
Okay, what we have here is a Ruger 1022 Charger. It has a sliding rail stock. Push the button, it slides into place. Now we'll warm it up with a 15 round magazine before we put the 110 drum magazine in it, 110 rounds. I've never used a drum magazine from this country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from this company. So I don't know how well it performs. It's brand new. I've never used it. I mean, I bought it a year ago, but I've never used it.
Yeah.
I've got a Bushnell scope on this thing, and we're going to put my brass catcher on it so we don't have all brass bouncing all around us. Now, I'm going to show you how this works, son, before you use it. This has a bio trigger on it. What that basically means is a lot of us call them double taps. When you pull the trigger, it fires, and when you release the trigger, it fires. It's just this simple. We'll rack it, check it. Now, see, I'll pull the trigger, and I'll release the trigger.
Okay.
You want some phones? I've got some in my bag. Okay, now I'm gonna show you.
Well, why don't you do it next door over?
Why?
Because you're so close to the microphone, you're gonna blow out the sound.
If you think so, I'll do that.
Yeah, because the thing, as a matter of fact, I think I need to turn it down some because just talking is blowing it out.
All right.
You shooting a gun is going to really blow it out.
Okay. So watch what you can do with this.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard it.
I guess you did, and I wouldn't even pull the trigger fast. I'm going to release it. And what you just heard was 15 rounds, back fast. Sometimes I'll shoot a target, sometimes I'll just shoot the ground because it's fun to watch it like in the movies.
Where you see the grass gets spin up.
We're watching the grass and gravel get spit up.
Yeah. Yeah. Here you go.
I know. You do you first, man. I'm still keeping an eye on this.
Okay, well, rack it. I'll check my load. Yep. I'll put the catcher on it. Now you want to try it? Here you go, son.
Yeah, that feels like a real movie kind of thing. I just can't see the target, so there's nothing pretty to run your grass. A pod, anyway. Okay. But that definitely feels like some real deal shit.
Believe it or not, it takes a while to load a 110-round drum, man. It's something else you don't get in the movie, right? 110 rounds is more than two boxes. So.
Yeah.
Well, actually, not that 110. That's more than a... Of course, you have boxes, and then you have double boxes. And anyway, yeah, it's unreasonable for a lot of reasons. Anybody that's actually seen people get shot, you know, like anybody that's ever taken a self-defense shooting class, they teach you, you don't shoot people in the head, you shoot them center mass, which is right between the two tits.
Mm-hmm.
That's center mass. And there's no reason not to shoot them there.
It's a bigger target, and you have more opportunity to do damage.
It's like in the movies, when they stab somebody, the two best places to stab somebody is right in the middle of the throat, and you just keep pushing. If you got a 5-inch knife, if you hit them in the center of the throat, you should be able to sever the spinal cord. That's the best place to hit them. Why would you be whacking around trying to make it messy with their veins? I mean, if you're coming up from behind them, maybe. But if you're in front of them, you go right dead center of the throat and shove it all the way into their spinal cord. As far as from them, you never hear anybody talk about the liver. You can stab somebody in the liver and they'll never see it coming. You know, why would you get it up here where they're going to see it and defend against it?
Yeah.
You go in the liver, twist and pull.
All those toxins get spilled into the body, I take it.
No! One of your biggest arteries right there in the liver.
Here we down
floor. All you have to do is nick it and they're dead, man. Yeah. And they never talk about that. I mean, I can see why you wouldn't shoot it with a bullet, because a bullet could shoot half the liver away and still miss. But with a knife, that ain't going to happen. You want to scissor it because you want to try to cut the liver in half.
Yeah.
And they're going to drop dead real quick. Mm-hmm. And it ain't going to be too messy. Yeah. It all stays inside. A lot of people that have cirrhosis and other problems with their liver, they have to have what's called the bypass. And that's when they have to bypass those big veins and the big arteries. That's the whole thing. Is like you talk about Don Pendleton serving in the military, or he was a writer, and I wonder how it is he would not go there.
Right.
I have never heard of either one of those things being used.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for a fact the knife to the center of the throat is something they teach you in the military.
Yeah. So they taught you that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In combat school, they teach you that.
Yeah, it's always funny because when you watch these action movies, the off switch of the human being is always snapping the neck, which A, would be a Herculean task just to get that done. But B, you don't just die, you know, and you don't even necessarily just get disabled, depending on how that happens. It makes more sense to just stab in the throat, like what you're talking about. If that's the technique you're going for, quick and silent death of the human being, you're not going to snap their neck like they do in the movies.
I'm sure they teach special forces that, because I know they do.
Yeah.
I was not special forces by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I was
your general issue.
The only thing they taught me about snapping the neck was in a hip throw, if you can snap the neck. It's not something they emphasize. most of our combat training was dealing with hand to hat, hand. I mean, most of it was trying not to be found.
Right.
Most of it.
Yeah. Just don't. Just don't. If you can avoid it, don't.
The combat school I went to, you had some classes, but the main thing was is they put you in a fake Vietnamese prison camp, and you have to try to escape. And that's your graduation party is escaping.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly what they taught us is hide and evade, but we did have some hand-to-hand combat stuff, just like you see the Army or the Marines doing in a movie. You know? It was very little.
Not a lot of Metal Gear Solid action going on. Now, it wasn't very Metal Gear Solid.
It's like the knife thing. They call it bayonet training. You've seen it in movies 100 times. Where you put
stabbing
it,
the saw dust. Dummy is up.
But you also use the bayonet as a knife. Yeah, most of what I saw Rambo doing was something you were supposed to be doing with a bayonet. Believe it or not, most bayonets, if your bayonet's sharp, it's after you're in combat and you ain't got nothing better to do, so you sharpen a bayonet.
Yeah.
They do not suggest it in combat. A bayonet is basically a spear. It's the point that's the weapon.
Right. So why again, though, was the headshots a bad idea?
For the same reason, first off, it's a small target. And I don't know how many times on the news you've heard of somebody getting shot in the head or shot in the face, and they survive it. And the truth is, anybody that's had serious accidental injury, and most especially if you've been gunshot, your chances are you're going to go through some kind of shock. The issue is when you're in shock, and I've been in shock enough, I can tell you can do things while you're in shock, and the danger hits you later. When you're in shock, you can cause more injury to yourself than what caused the shock. Never been in hand-to-hand combat like we're talking about, but I've been in plenty of street fights. In fact, most of the action I saw was in street fights in the Philippines, believe it or not. And I boxed in the circus, if you want to call it that. I call it that because they call it smokers, but you're supposed to be boxing. Basically, it's street fight in the ring, but I know what kind of damage you do when you hit somebody over and over again, and I know what it's like when you get hit over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of street fights, it's not the boxing part of it that does serious damage. It's the kicking and the falling.
Yeah.
It does the serious damage.
So basically what I'm hearing is that the headshot doesn't incapacitate necessarily. And
it's also much harder to hit.
Yeah. That's part of the point, though. They're trying to show you what a badass Mac Mullen is, that he's doing nothing but headshots. He'd survive the zombie apocalypse for sure because it's nothing but headshots.
So another thing you see in movies all the time is the guy that's shooting with a gun in each hand. Now, I've had matched gun where I've tried it. I tried it with Smith & Wesson. 22. Okay, I don't believe you do that.
Yeah.
First off, when you're shooting one gun after another, you have to get a rhythm up between one trigger and the other trigger. When you shoot both of them at once, most of the time you miss both times.
Yeah.
When you start angling, you might hit one, like with your I'm right-handed, so I might hit the target or within the target with my right hand, but I never know what my left hand's doing.
Yeah.
And I have practiced it. I mean, we're not talking about just trying it once. I have practiced it. I started with 45s because I really wanted to do it. And then I tried it with 380. And then I tried it with 22. And those Smith & Wesson 22s are good 22s. They're a model that's become kind of a collector's item called the Sports. They're kind of made to carry in the field. Right from the factory, they're easy to aim. They're well balanced. They'd be a great gun to teach somebody handgun use with. You fire them whether you remember it or not. They're blue. The guns are blue. Anyway, I tried. I spent probably 6-8 hours trying to learn something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do it. it. I knew a guy who could do it with Western style 22. You know, he dressed cowboy. He was like a cowboy shooter. Mm-hmm. And I knew a guy that could do it. But what he did was like you see in the Westerns, one pistol went in front of him, you go boom, and the other pistol would go in front of him, you go boom.
Yeah.
Not shooting from the side like that. That's what we're talking about. It's just like I showed you, and you shoot that way, you level the pistol in front of your chest, yet you're centered. That's what gives it to you. It's like a lot of the firing positions Bowen uses in those books are military positions, like squatting down and taking the firing stance. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm too old to even do that anymore. Because basically, it's like this. I'm sitting down on like this. I can't. I'm too old to even do it.
So, okay. Well, I mean, are you pressing against something to do that? Because what you were showing me
you
had your back against the chair. You had one leg one leg down.
What you're sitting on your heels. Sit on your heels with your foot forward. And you want your legs spread enough to give you balance.
Okay.
But you're supposed to be doing it like this.
Right.
Or like this.
Yeah. I've also got the head mindset of you doing pew-pew cowboy stuff, but you're talking for your aiming.
Right.
Steady yourself. And I guess you're low because you don't want somebody shooting back at you, and you don't want to give them an easy target. Is that
right? And it gives you good balance. See, you're trying to do it without the weight of the weapon.
Right.
See, this leg's out here because that's where the weight of the weapon is.
That microphone weighs about as much as a small pistol, but I'm not going to mess with it. I could probably do that if I wanted to.
Okay. Then you have a rifleman's stance. Mm-hmm. Combat rifle stance, which is like this.
Right. So you're on your belly.
Okay.
Laying on your
now,
belly.
Now, what would be your target? It would be your head. Why are you doing this? Because your body is behind something, and you're only firing when you lift up. So
you're not exposing your position. You're not exposing your body except for the hand.
Yeah.
You just acknowledge that headshots are tricky anyway.
Right.
Very tricky.
Well, and another thing they never talk about.
I do appreciate that a man in his 70s is still able to get down on his belly and you know, clearly you've maintained at least some of your abilities.
Oh, I'm still pretty limber. It just hurts.
Yeah, you know, looking at you gives me hope because I definitely want to still be able to do stuff. And I'll see these folks that are only in their 60s.
Every chance you get.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in the shower. A lot of times I'll sit in the shower with hot and I do this.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically doing a monkey stance where you're bumping your knuckles against the ground.
Yeah, I'm trying, you know, a lot of bend overs and stuff. I stretch from side to side like this all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a reason for yoga. I don't do it, but I understand the reason for it. You try to stay as limber as possible.
By the way, when you're talking about the dual shooters, have you ever met anybody that's ambidextrous who tried to do that? Because it seems like one of your main issues is that you're not doing so well with your non-dominant hand when you shoot once with your dominant hand, you do okay. You switch to your non-dominant, not so great. So have you ever run across anybody that's ambidextrous?
No, because you hardly ever run across anybody that tries to shoot that way.
Right, yeah.
And I'm wearing guys and guns all the time.
Right.
Nobody tries that crap except some dummy like me.
So tell me this too. Since there are so many shooters in this country especially, why do they keep putting that shit in the movies?
But that's part of the fun of it. I mean, it wouldn't be fun if you didn't have some kind of challenge.
But, and that gets us back to the Mac Baldwin thing, is you do say, you know, if you're somebody who's in a combat situation, the smart move is not to go for the headshot. But if you're son-in-law, good shot. If you're Mac Baldwin, good shot. You go for those headshots, you're basically, maybe you're showing off, or maybe you're just making it a challenge for yourself, but he's consistently pulling that off. And that's why he's the executioner.
The thing that always amazes me is he's supposed to be a sniper in Vietnam, and he doesn't hardly ever do that as an executioner.
Right.
He's usually using a handgun or an Uzi or a Mac-10. In fact, he does go to work for the government, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when he does...
Well, you were saying some special feds were after him. Did they finally catch up with him or what?
Well, he kind of more or less surrendered to him. One of these feds, the president wanted to set up a special security group that only the president controlled. In other words, in all the books, they take their orders direct from the president, but it doesn't show as a legitimate group. In other words, nobody...
They're off the books.
They're off the books. A good deal of the time, all through the teen books and the 20 books, this Fed is trying to get Bowen to come aboard. Because Bowen has to do things on his own way. And even after the president was going to accept that, Bowen had to finish his tour of the mafia first. So he cut a deal that...
Take the heat off from the feds, at least.
It was like 12 days or whatever it is. It reminded me of the 12 days of Christmas. He had 12 days to crisscross the country killing every mafioso he could. And then he had to have a vacation. But he meets this Fed who's beautiful, and she's not really a field agent. She's more of a head computer electronics expert or whatever. And they fall in love. That's the other thing. Bowen fall in love with everybody.
Well, he clearly has a very kind and open heart.
Yeah.
Being Sergeant Mercer and everything.
The thing is he has so much love for him, he doesn't hook up with him because anybody that gets close to him gets dead.
He's sort of like an opposite of Bond in that regard because he hooks with a bunch of people and every movie, one of these ladies is going to get killed.
He don't really do that.
I'm saying the movies where with Bowen, he realizes that danger and so he's afraid for their lives, and he doesn't want to have a serious long-term relationship because of the threat that poses to them. Plus, he did have somebody die earlier on, right? And so he's haunted by the memory of that one girl that he was with that died.
That was after he went to work for the feds, I was talking about.
Oh, is that? Okay.
He ends up marrying her.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
And she runs the office, he runs the field.
Now, is he just working with the government, or is he working with a group within the government? Because I understand he eventually has his own team for a period. So is this before that, or during that, or what?
The president puts him in charge of Stony Man Farm.
Okay.
That's what it's called. And he has teams that work for him. But the books are mostly about what he's doing.
Right.
Which is working by himself. The one I'm reading now is one I found real cheap. I think it's number 193.
Mm-hmm.
He's fixing to be inserted into Vietnam to go after this soldier who's he's a merc now, but he's not so different than Bowen. His daddy's a real rich guy,
mm-hmm.
and he served in the military as a lieutenant. He's got this hard on, not for the mafia, but for communism.
Okay.
So his group has been working. Sometimes,
what is Mac Bolin's political ideology? Does that even come into play in these books? What is Mac Bolin's political ideology?
Like, he don't have one.
He doesn't have one. He's just
he makes a point of it. And actually, in this book, he's working for Ronnie Reagan. They don't use Reagan's name, but since they're talking about Iran-Contra,
right?
And this other guy, he's been working in South America as a merc, but sometimes he has to pay his guys out of his own pocket because his thing, he's not that much different. He's trying to kill communists, but his father finds out his brother, who was in Vietnam, left a son behind, and the guy... The merc in Vietnam that is going to turn the son over, his father's a very wealthy arms manufacturer. He's the one that tracking location program for the Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
right?
You know, they don't mention
time and place.
But hey, yep. And the guy to turn over his son's son wants the program because he's going to charge him $3 million. And then somebody gave him the idea, look, this guy does this. Isn't that worth more? More money, the guy has sent his spare son. Well, it is. It's the way he loved his first son, but he put all of his hopes into him. His second son is just as good or better,
right.
But he'll
get the love, though.
He'll sacrifice him. Mm-hmm. To get the son of the son.
So what happened to the first son, though? Did he die or something? That's why it's so hot.
He was killed in Vietnam.
Okay, so
but
the son's fine.
He had a wife and a son in Vietnam. And he don't care that he sacrifices his second son to get the son of the first son.
Right.
He'll become a traitor and sacrifice his kid. But his kid that's carrying it thinks he's carrying codes to a Swiss bank account. He doesn't know his father's turning traitor to get this kid. So Mac Bowen's dropping in.
To stop that from happening.
Yeah, and the exchange is going to happen in Hanoi. Been there. Almost right across the street from the old presidential palace.
Okay.
So you've probably been there too. The old American embassy and the presidential palace.
I don't know if I made it over to there, but we stayed at the Hanoi Hilton, so that was an experience.
How did you stay in a prison?
Because they took the prison, they chopped it down into a little bitty museum, and they put a big nice hotel on top of the grounds, and I'm literally looking down into the museum from my hotel room window.
So you stayed next door to the park?
No, it's on the grounds, though. Like, the grounds of that prison camp have shrank down to a smaller section. So if I look out my window, I'm seeing the glass.
So now it really is a Hilton.
I mean, it's not a Hilton necessarily, but essentially, it's a little hotel on the grounds now. By the way, that was funny too, because they're still very nationalistic. And so you go there, and I gave up on reading the history after a while, because everything was like, glorious, people revolution, and we treated John McCain so well. You know, he was just injured in his when his plane went down. We didn't do anything to him. We knocked him back up to hell. You know, all this bullshit.
Still a little warm. We'll let it calm down a little bit.
Okay. What does heat do to it?
Well, you know, I bought this gun a year ago, and it's been test fired a couple of times, but you really need, all guns need, you know, like 500 rounds run through them to break them in. They're like a car or anything else.
Yeah, one thing that was cool in Cambodia, they basically, from all the wars and stuff that they've had, all the conflicts they've had, there's all these armaments that get left behind. And so somebody just up and collected a bunch of that stuff and put it into somebody's big backyard, and they turn it into a museum. So you just walk into this big backyard, you're sweating, of course, because Cambodia. We were there during a rainy season, so there are all these little puddles and little muddy portions of stuff that you have to go around. But it's just a bunch of husks of tanks and anti-aircraft equipment and all this stuff getting rusted out, having greens growing through them and everything else, and just this graveyard of all these armaments. It was pretty neat. They had a chopper and a plane too. A chopper and a small jet.
I mean, it shouldn't be surprising. I mean, you do all this traveling. When I was in the service, I very seldom spent much time in the better parts of town. Not every place I went was, I guess, all that seedy. You know, in other words, you'd be pretty safe day or night as long as you stuck to the streets and the sidewalk.
Rough, but not dangerous necessarily.
Rough, but yeah. But the poverty was never far away. There was places I was in Vietnam and in the Philippines that looked just like Mexico. And see, the last time I was in Mexico was, I think it was around 2011 or 2012. And I just parked the truck right there at the border and crossed over at Del Rio and went walking around. I was shopping, but I didn't have a lot of time to spend. It was summertime, so I kind of found something I wanted to buy as a gift, but I thought I'd come back. And that was before you needed a
passport.
Yeah, when I was a kid, man, when I was in the service, we went to Mexico all the damn time.
That's what thing Piquita was saying too, was how much Thailand especially reminded her of Mexico when she was growing up. So like 1980s, 1990s period.
Well, I probably...
But again, Cambodia is about 40 years past, back from that because of all the conflicts they've had there.
Yeah, well, see, I can't really... I remember the stuff that was going on in Cambodia and guys telling me stuff.
Yeah.
But I can't comment. I was never in Cambodia.
Right, yeah. You haven't read any of those spinoff books, Stony Man, or any of that kind of stuff?
No.
And there's another spinoff series too, right? It isn't like the anti-terrorist stuff where you solo like its own series as well, or something like that?
Look, he does go after terrorists and the executioner. It's all done from Stony Man Park. It's all, you know.
But he's got his own little Torchwood where there's a team that he worked with that's off doing their own shit too.
There are some missions. He's got his own teams that he put together from his own guys. They do, like, I just read this book where they were off like in the Himalayas and they were going after a gun runner that was operating, I can't remember, I think it was the Himalayas, it might have been the Alps, I don't know. Mm-hmm. He was called the Dragon. It just so happened that his path was crossing with the CIA guy, and that CIA guy was trying to destroy his group because he basically was doing the same thing that Mac Bowen was doing. He thought that his group should be the only one with that kind of power and control over things. He was trying to show that Mac Bowen's group was out of sorts. He was actually interfering with the first group, so his group should be disbanded. In fact, that's the book. I think it's 63, where his wife gets killed because Stony Man Farm is being attacked by this merc group, which knows too much. They shouldn't be able to have that kind of information. So it's obvious that the CIA guy has gotten a hold of the secure information and is using it against them. The group that was in the mountains or whatever to get this guy called the Dragons, the CIA guy right in front of the president said, see, they're interfering with us. We already got guys on the Dragon and you're going to mess it up. So when I got the phone call, I burned them. They know they're coming after them. The Bowen don't work with dumb shits. That was the other thing, is they were interfering with their communication. And even though they did that, Bowen was able to complete his mission, which was an important mission. That other team, while they didn't get the Dragon, the fact that it was an ambush didn't matter because they got them anyway. I don't know what happened because I ordered the next group of books, all the books in the 60s. But the next book in line, and I suspected this, but it came today in the mail and I looked at it, has nothing to do with the mission. It's not going to tell me what to me that's a cliffhanger. What happened after his wife died? They left him sitting there in the rain with her body. Something's got to happen. What happened with the CIA guy?
Right.
Seems to me Mac Bowen needs to go kill that motherfucker. Anyway, the next book in the series is nothing but an explanation of Mac Bowen's tactics with drawn pictures of all the weapons that they've talked about in the books.
So it's the executional battle armory.
It's called the New War Book. Mac Bowen's New War Book. So it's not even a novel. I mean,
I haven't
read any of it, but I mean, you're thumbing. It's the only one I've seen with a bunch of pictures in it.
Right, right, yeah.
But that's not what I'm interested in.
Right.
So I have to look at the next one in line. Hopefully, I know I ordered it. Hopefully it was in that group because I ordered from two different secondhand book companies.
So what started you to start reading these books again?
You.
Oh, yeah?
You brought the memory up. We started doing this stuff and talking about 007, and I remembered in that one book, 007 crosses tracks with Mac Bowen. I've got that book coming too.
And you say the books are trash. You say they're not even, like, spelling isn't correct, grammar isn't correct, they're fairly slight novels, but they're enjoyable trash is what you're telling me.
There's something to do while I'm sitting out on the patios puffing on a cigar or sitting on the can. When I go to the bathroom, I need something else to think about. I'm sorry, I just do.
Uh-huh.
Me and the throne is not enough.
Yeah, definitely I need a phone or a book or something. Yeah. It's not the most interesting activity to engage in.
Well, you know, back when you were a kid, I a lot of times I gave you toilet gag gifts.
Mm.
You know, all the kids started on the grandkids yet, even though, hell, I got grandkids now of middle age. Mm-hmm. They're in their 30s.
Yeah.
I've always done that. Yeah. People done it to me. Hell, they used to give me these, what were they called, John books or something?
Oh, Uncle John's Bathroom Reader?
Yeah.
It's just a bunch of factoids and short stories and stuff.
Yeah.
I've got one of those somewhere.
Well,
I had at least.
I lost track of how many people gave those to me. Hell, for all I know, you gave me one when you were a teenager.
Maybe.
But people used to give them to me, but they didn't last that long because, let's face it, I can read a Clive Cussler novel in a week just sitting on the john once a day.
Right, yeah.
And I don't like to spend a lot of time in the toilet. I mean, 15 minutes on the outside. I'm serious. I it hurts my ass to sit on the toilet.
And for me, it basically depends on how interested I am in the other thing I'm doing besides shitting. As I was saying, the numbers on those covers made a difference to me because it was like comic books. I knew that it was a serialized storytelling, high-intensity action.
And just like 007, it is serial. And you can read them separately, but they're not like Clive Custer books. Clive Custer books are semi-serial.
You'll have elements carry over, but they're self-contained units of everything.
Right. When you're talking 007, and you can say that most of the executioner stuff is self-contained, but you're getting a lot more story if you read them in sequence. I read a bunch of them out of sequence. I mean, first off, it's hard as hell to get a 10-year segment of them anymore. Spend a bunch of money on those.
Yeah.
It kind of hacks me off having to spend $350 for some of them.
Right.
Because I don't think they're that much entertainment. But I want another story. And it won't last because they're a lot cheaper. And like if I buy them at half price books when I'm just in there, they're $1, $1.70, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But when I order them, they're always $3 or $3.50. I've gotten a few for $2.59. But you always got to. You gotta remember the shipping. I ain't gonna pay for shipping. Most of them, you have to buy a certain amount. You know, you have to buy $20 or you have to buy $15 shipping. So I'm gonna get the best ones I can. I'm not gonna just order them.
Is this the Cussler books you're talking about or the executioners you're talking about?
The executioner.
Okay. I'm just checking to make sure.
The Cussler books, that's the other thing. Some of them books come out. I have gotten a new, and I don't understand it. I really don't understand it. The book will be coming out and they'll list it for $7 or $12. Okay, now I like them enough, I'll pay that kind of money. And I'll pre-order them. I almost always get them for less. Supposed to be $10.53. I get them for $7.20. They were $12. I ain't gonna spend $15, $18. That just ain't gonna happen. No paperback is worth it. And you can buy them used. I hate to buy, you know, it's now here's the difference between Clive Cussler and Don Pendleton. I've never seen a hardcover Don Pendleton. But all of the Clive Cussler books come in hardcover. And sometimes you can get them for next to nothing because like me, nobody wants them in hardcover. I mean, I have bought them on Amazon as cheap as 50 cents. So that meant they didn't even cost me $4.50 for a hardcover book.
Right.
But I hate them. For one, they're hard to balance on the toilet. Did you know that? They're hard to hold on the toilet. You know, you have to put them down and squeeze. It's a pain.
You put them on the sink. You set them on the sink and you read them that way. You just got to crane your neck a little bit.
First off, you can't do that in my bed.
Okay.
I mean, I know the sink is next to the toilet, but the sink is sitting high.
Yeah. So you got the book up high and you're looking down at it. It's not at fucking eye level.
Son, I'd be pissing on the wall. I got to pay attention to where my junk's going.
Sure, sure.
Do you really do that?
Huh? Well, I mean, I don't take a lot of hard covers into the bathroom, so it doesn't. It's really an issue.
Man, I've always got a marker.
But I wouldn't want a paperback in the bathroom really either because the spines are too tight. I usually like a magazine or a comic or something because they're floppy, they're loose, and so they're easy to turn.
Yeah, but I don't read that crap like you do.
I understand. I'm just saying, in terms of just
some of the ones. I won't take in the bathroom because I know what's going to happen to them if they go.
Right. No worries. But yeah, no, it's just because of they're made to be flopped around and stay in place. You just pop it down, you keep your page. Where with a paperback, you usually have to put something in there to save your spot or dog-eared or something.
And yeah, I always, you know, and I don't like the dog-eared.
Yeah.
I
don't want to fuck my stuff.
For some reason, I misplaced my book marker.
Mm-hmm.
I just grabbed one sheet of toilet paper and put it in there.
That works. Back to the executioner. So these things have been coming out more or less monthly since the 60s. So they're up into the 600s now, from what I understand, at least.
I don't think they're coming out anymore.
But I'm going by...
If I recall, they stopped them in like 1992.
Maybe so, but Wikipedia was saying they're up in the 600s. I don't know how credible that is. I have to look up. Probably check Goodreads or something and get a better idea, I'd expect. But again, that suggests that quality somewhat similar to comic books, where it's just the supposable immediate routine periodical. And it's tough to talk about the executioner without talking about his most famous, arguably more famous, ripoff, The Punisher.
You know, the truth of the matter is, other than the movie, movies, I know zip about the Punisher.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, it kind of came out after your time. But, yeah, literally, like, the origin is pretty much the same.
Well, I saw the movie, but yeah. I own the movie.
Right, so you can see the similarities.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. You know, Mac Bowen don't live in no sewer.
Well, that's from the movies, though. In the books, he's got people he works with. He's got a van, a battle van. He has a bunch of weapons in. There's the Punisher Armory, which is like that book you described where they're actually showing all of his weapons page after page. Like, I use this one, and this does this. And basically, kind of like a Guns and Ammo Wars, explains what he does with his weapons and why he uses this particular weapon under what circumstances, stuff like that. So, you wonder why somebody like Mac Bowen wouldn't be the comic book character. And I think the problem is they started doing comic books with Punisher.
Well, he's got a battle wagon. He definitely ripped off Mac Bowen.
Definitely. Well, and also the Punisher, the Executioner, they're not that far. You know, they're both Vietnam vets, all that kind of shit. They tried to get the Executioner into comics eventually, but they waited until the 90s, and there's a smaller company called Innovation that was owned by a dentist, or was financed by a dentist, that finally pulled the plug on it. But they had decent quality color comics, and they came out with the Executioner miniseries with art by Mike Deodato Sr. I picked it up when it was coming out. One of its big selling points was that they had a supposedly indestructible cover on the first issue. What it was made out of Tyvek, and you've dealt with plants and stuff, so you know how that works. You know, like, you can tear Tyvek, you might have to kind of work it a little bit, but you can eventually tear it, and you can definitely wrinkle it and stuff. But it was, you know, a little bit stronger than the norm. I made a point of testing it, of course, and the comics were all right. The artwork is pretty good because I like that the style of Deodato, but it just wasn't that engaging because it basically was a Punisher comic book, and I'd already read plenty of Punisher comics. I ended up paying a premium price to get it from a smaller publisher and have it more grounded and less comic booky. But you know, the parallels are definitely there.
Yeah, according to this, the first spinoff was Able Team that was started in 1982. That same year, he started the Phoenix Force, and then in 1991, Stony Man started. Able Team ran from 1982 to 1991. Phoenix Force ran from 82 to 91. Stony Man ran from, well, see, this doesn't make sense because it says 1983 to 1991, then it says 1991 to 2015.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what that means.
Right. Maybe they restarted the series from number one or something? Came out with a variant cover?
Well, there's two here I never even heard anything of. One was called Caribbee, and it was 2012 and 2013. And one was called SOBs, Jack Killed, and that was 1983 to 1990. And I hadn't even heard of those. Now we're going to answer your question. Then he went, the Super Bowen book started in 1983, and they ran to 2015.
What's a Super
Bowen? I've seen them in the used bookstores.
Okay.
Two of those I've never seen. I have seen Phoenix Force, but I've seen the Super Bowen.
You said there were movies. Did you ever see any of them?
Huh?
You said there are movies of Mac Bowen. Did you ever see any of them?
I got one of them somewhere.
Oh, yeah?
That's special? It's just called The Executioner. I think it was Dolph Lundgren.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Okay, the Mac Bowen book ran till 2020.
Oh, okay. Pretty recent finale then. So how many volumes does it say?
Yeah, the first set of Mac Bowen book, there's 464 of the execution. I think. That didn't make sense. Something's not making sense.
I wonder if the numbers they had when I read on Wikipedia were all inclusive.
This is a list of all. No, that was Mac Bowen. That's not being executioner. Oh, they're including all of these as executioner.
So that's probably where they got the numbers from, is being all inclusive and all of its.
And apparently there was a magazine. It was called the Executioner Mystery Magazine.
Hmm.
I didn't know that. Okay, the Executioner, because he's counting all of these as Mac Bowen book. The Executioner, and I know that's fucking wrong, because I can look at the copyrights and know that's wrong. Oh, I get it. He's been releasing a couple of books a year. Apparently, the last book they're showing is 2020, that was 464. And I know I read 400 and something books.
Uh-huh.
I've got it at the house somewhere. You know, I keep track of my reading. Because of that, I have to keep track of my books. Like with Clive Cussler, I keep mine on the computer because, let's face it, you know, when you burn a book a day, you really need to keep it. It'd be a lot of handwriting. So I was wrong. them. The highest book I've read so far is 346. The two I'm reading now, I think one was a 123 and the other one was a 98 or something.
Yeah.
And I haven't added those to the list. And I've read 3, 4, 5, 10, 12, 14, 17, 19. Read all the 20s. Read all of the 30s except 31. All of the 40s except for 48. All of the 50s except for 54. And I know that I'm going to read all the 60s. I read 60 and 62. 62 is the one where she gets killed.
Okay.
63 is Magbone Armory. And I know I've ordered all the 60s, but the only 70 I've read is 71. I've read 264 and 265, 283, and then 333, 335. 341, 345, and 346.
And again, we're not talking about, oh, I read the, you know, Eye of the Falcon or whatever the fuck the book's called, issue numbers, just like in comic books. This is weird.
It's easier to keep track of that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm 100%.
On all my other reading, I have to put a title.
No, I'm not going to keep track of that. I know. That's what I'm saying. It's like this book series is such a weird little hybrid. There's a lot of comic book elements to this thing.
Yeah, it's fine and easy for me. I mean, because I can't call them novels.
They're episodes.
Huh?
They're like episodes.
I guess you could call them serial episodes. Yeah. That would be the best, but I just soon call them a number.
Right.
And there's reasons, some of the reasons why I haven't read those fill-ins is because I don't have to. If I've already read one, it might have already told me what happened to the one before. Also, you gotta remember, these things are ancient. I can look at the copyright.
Mm-hmm.
I've read most of my copyright are in the 70s and the 80s. To a person like me, the 80s doesn't seem like a long time ago. And I can remember the 80s like they were yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I don't want to remember them, but I do.
Right? Well, again, like comic books, anything from the 90s up is new shit, as far as I'm concerned. That's that new shit. And that's a span of going on, you know, 20, going to 30 odd years now. So I totally feel you.
Well, and you know,
70s and 80s was the seminal shit. That was the stuff where I got...
Look, every once in a while, I'll see a comic book that just makes me go gaga. And it's usually because it's 60s or earlier. There were some in the 70s that I thought of. And some of them, I'm not prejudiced. I liked Archie comic books. I read them right alongside Marvel and DC. And I didn't realize how many DC comics I read. But I did read a lot of DC comics. Because every once in a while, I'll be thinking about something. I'll look it up. Is, you know, a DC comic or a Heritage comic.
Yeah.
I don't even know who wrote Archie. I can't tell you.
There are a variety of people on that one. That's fun.
That's a pistol round and a rifle. One of the points of all this that we're out here since we've been talking about all that fancy gunplay, and you've already been sitting here trying to shoot it semi-auto, now going into auto. Now think about the control and trying to hit a target. Are you going to do that flying around doing bubble backflips and rolls across the dirt? Think about it. Just because you're not all that trained with it doesn't mean that you can't see that you ain't going to be doing that sort of thing.
What is the difference between the fact and the fantasy?
This is a pistol round in a heavy rifle.
Yeah.
Not you're not firing a big heavy rifle round.
Uh-huh.
You know, like a 308. Now, it might be easier with a 5.6, you know, which is basically a heavy 22 round. See, it's more like a 22-250 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But still, this is just a pistol round in a heavy rifle. How hard is it to stay on target in automatic fire? Just doing that alone requires training and practice. New magazine.
Uh-huh.
Gotta break them in. Yep. Well, it's locked now.
You can shoot that one. I want you to shoot something too.
Well, but I can shoot anytime.
Okay.
That magazine you just shot, you bought all the bullets.
didn't care about the accuracy on that one. I just wanted to go rapid fire and enjoy it.
And did you?
Yeah, it's fun.
How quickly did those?
Oh, that was way smoother than the bump stock. I wasn't struggling with that at all. I barely had to do anything to get it to go.
That's good. And I'm eager to see if they all fire. It sounded right to me, but. Mm-hmm. And see, that was with, I mean, I had wad cutters in there and hollow points in there, and they were old ammo.
Uh-huh.
See, that's reliable.
Yeah.
Now let's let that cool down. It's hot. Don't want to burn the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can read all the books and watch all the movies you want to until you've done the real thing.
Yeah.
So now when you see a documentary and somebody's actually doing it, you know more about what it's like. Mm-hmm. I know me, like you were just talking about how I can still stretch, but I can't run. And I used to fly when I ran. I could fly when I ran when I was in my 40s. But by 45, things started happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I could understand. And apparently they knew this back in the 50s when they wrote 007.
Mm-hmm.
45 would be a good retirement age for somebody who had to be an action guy. So if Matt Bowen, when he started out, was 32 years old. And I'm reading him now, 1983. How old is
it? Well, you're saying it's not necessarily like Bond, though. They don't necessarily do those books in real time, do they? Do they actually have dates and times and stuff like that?
They're not giving dates and times, but they're serial.
You're right.
But
if he's doing a book in 2 hours, he could be doing a book a day. It could be a year. A year and a half worth of adventures the entire career.
That's what I was laughing about. You got to realize those books go back to back with numbers. You read the copyright. There was a time, that's what I was just talking about. There was a time when he were producing those books one a month. He may have wrote them until 2020, but then they were down to 3 a year.
Well, obviously Pendleton stopped writing them like in 80, and a bunch of people named Don Pendleton in as
pseudonym. I know some of them have a shared name.
And you told me you could tell the differences in the writing from the different writers between Pendleton.
Sure you can. And that's another thing that we never talk about is writing style. And I don't mean just writing styles between different writers. I'm talking about writing styles of time. You read something written in the 1900s or the 17th, 1800s. There's a cadence to it and a language to it and a structure to it. And then you get into the 20s, they had the classics were all written during those times. You get into the 40s and the 50s, it's a totally different way of writing. And I'll bring this up. This is something that younger people be interested in. It might be something you'd be interested in reading. This is a series I read this year, and I just accidentally stumbled on them. I think I ordered one from Amazon or something because I stumbled on it, and then I realized it was a series. This guy's name is Stephen Cole. Spells it Stephen, but depending on what you're looking for, because he did go by Steve Cole too. And he authored these books. The first book was in 2006. It was Thieves Like Us. The second book in 07, it was called The Aztec Code. And then the third book is called Bloodline Cipher, and it was done in 2008. I thoroughly enjoyed the books.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're a little bit odd, but they're also done in a British style. Basically, what the books are about is about these wayward kids. They're all different ages and with different pasts, and they're not all British, but I think three of them are. This guy, he's an older guy, he collects them, and they all have their own skills. Unlike 007 and Mac Bowen, they have to get together to get all them skills working.
Uh-huh.
He trains them as a team to be thief. He treats them well. They live well. And we've talked about health. They live in his home, which are always very large, very lavish, very secure. And they always have the kids always have these huge party rooms with the biggest and best of everything. You know, all the biggest and best horses.
Boys. There, it's a great series. I wish there was a fourth one. Anyway, this guy wrote a bunch of the Doctor Who stuff. I just wanted to bring that up, those series and the name of the book. He's written a lot of younger kid stuff, too. You know, your listeners wouldn't be interested in those, but the ones I just mentioned is a series, and you can buy them cheap when you buy them used. They're not pulp. I'd say the writing's, since it's British and written so differently, but I would say he's a better writer than Clive Cussler. He certainly put a lot into the books. Some of it seems to like to be getting monotonous,
yeah.
But he's doing it to make you feel like the guy, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He's trying to bring you into the book by doing it. I thought that would be worth mentioning.
Okay.
You do blow through 50 rounds pretty quick.
Yeah.
This is that new magazine I haven't used before. Also, I know for a fact about the last 15 rounds of this. Actually, about 40 rounds of it. The ammunition is probably 3 or 4 years old. But there's ammo in here that's a mixture of different kinds, and some of it could be 20, 25 years old. So mm-hmm. If we have problems, it's not the rifle's issue.
So did you have any final thoughts on Executioner now that you've just about wrapped it up? Because you said you got into the Stony Men or the Phoenix Force, or who'd you get into?
No, I've read some up in the 300 and 400, but what happened is as the Executioner evolved, so did the people around him. He'd gotten to a point to where he had a woman who was a member of the team also. You know, that's one of the things about the Executioner. He fell in love a lot.
You mentioned, but it was too dangerous and he had to turn
right,
away.
Right, right. And in this case, he thought he'd finally found a situation where he'd work. And so this chick, April, she was kind of a computer geek. And
so I'm assuming by this point we're into like the 80s or something?
Oh yeah, it was in the 80s. In fact, it was in the upper 80s. I think it was about 1987, if I remember the copyright. The Stony Man part came from Stony Man Farm. That was his base. After he went to work for the government, and they gave him a base. I think it was in Virginia. And it was a gorgeous spot, a lot of acreage, and it was set up to look like a farm. But then they had this underground base that mm-hmm. nobody knew about. They had a mole in the government who was like an ex-CIA guy, and he was doing the same stuff as them. And he was jealous. He didn't want them to have any of his shine.
Yeah, you talked about that one before, remember?
Yeah.
That?
Yeah. Anyway, so him and this Russian KGB guy were destroying Stony Man Farm from the inside, not knowing what the other one was doing. And it finally came together as an attack on the farm, and a bunch of the people were killed, including April. I had Dickens of a time, and I found this in some of those other serial books, where when you have a big moment like that, trying to get the books that follow is kind of hard to do.
Right.
It's like they become precious to somebody. I finally got the books together, because what they did is right after that happened, their next book had some short stories in it, but mostly it was about the character Mac Bowen, and all about him and about all the weapons and stuff he used. So it was an explanation of anybody that's read the books didn't need. I'm sure that they opened a book of Jane's weapons. You know, there's a book called Jane's. They've been publishing them forever. When I was a kid, I'd go to the library because they were always reference books and just read, stare and read and learn about all that stuff. They have them on the ships and on the aircraft, ordnance like missiles and anyway, anything having to do with war and different, like what the British or the French or the Germans and the Americans have, mm-hmm. it's all broken down so you can see it with the explanations that's available. I'm sure that even though apparently Pendleton that wrote it did know something about some of this stuff, I'm pretty sure that, because when you read it, it sounds like James, like he's copying it right. And some of the stuff is just, it's wrong. When you've handled weapons, like Mac Bowen's gun, you've fired enough weapons now, you know when you're firing auto weapons, the good ones like I usually have, when you empty a magazine, they lock open so that when you can just slap a magazine in there and hit your lock switch and it shuts the chamber for you. That never seems to happen with Mac Bowen, even when there's weapons that I know damn well that's exactly what they do. Mm-hmm. Has never seemed to do it. Because he always has the rack slide after he does it. And I'm going, what the heck, you know? Everyone I ever fired open. So anyway, you know, there's always stuff like that. And of course, as those books went on, you know, in the early books up into the 80s, there are a lot of misspellings and silly crap like that in the books. And then, but as times changed, as time went on, the books got better put together and the spelling got better. Some of the what I call shorthand. He liked to use all these terms, especially for like guys that have been to Vietnam, you know, all the shorthand terms that we use. But he would present them in such a way that I never heard them like
right.
that. But I guess that's because he's always trying, he's always saying the same thing and trying to find different ways of saying it.
Right.
Anyway, after April died, there was a period there that was still interesting. He left Stony Man.
I'm assuming this is, what, after 100 or so? How far into the series is this?
No, he didn't make it to 100 before that happened.
Okay, so that's what I was wondering about. Because, like, the Stony Man group and all that kind of stuff, is that different from the guys that are in Phoenix Force and that?
Yeah, see, okay.
That only be too much. I was just trying to figure out like, right, timeline right, wise where we at.
During the Mafia War,
yeah,
he got together with some of his guys from Vietnam.
Yeah.
And that was Abel Teague.
Okay, Abel Teague.
Okay, and there was this...
I know he's got like multiple teams over the course of the series.
Yeah, right. Then some of those guys actually survived long enough to become part of Stony Man 2.
Okay.
There's just a couple of them, but they did it.
Okay.
Okay. Stony Man teams and the Phoenix teams are kind of the same thing, because when he was with Stony Man, he went by Colonel John Phoenix.
Okay, that's where Phoenix Force got
that's from. Where the Phoenix stuff came in.
Okay.
Yeah, it happened in the 60s. I think it was 63 where she gets killed, and then it takes back up in 66, but it doesn't really finish out until like 68 or 69. In fact, her funeral was several books later, you know, and then it's like a mention at the end of the book. They're talking about what he's doing and what's going on at the funeral.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't go to the funeral. But there's a bunch of the books in the 70s that I haven't been able to find. The book that I'm on now, which is probably the last one I'm going to worry about for a while, Hollywood Hell, is number 77.
Because what you were telling me before was that you'd kind of gotten invested into some of the people that was on the Stony Man group.
I got invested in the team. The team was what made the books, the old books, what made them interesting to me. It's because I'm that fucking old. I remember stuff about how people used to talk and how people used to act.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in the James Bond books, all the prejudice and the way they talk in the books just wouldn't fly today, man. I mean, it's... you can call it off color.
Yeah.
Or on color, however you want to put it.
Right.
It just wouldn't fly today, and it doesn't make sense to, I think, most people in the general public.
Yeah.
You know, there's just not that many people that openly act like that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was commonplace for people to say those words and talk that way and act that way.
I'm sure also the treatment of women's probably a lot different in those books.
The misogynistic, but see, that's all part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, nowadays, a woman would just shoot the guy here in Texas. I mean, fuck him. Boom! I don't care if you do have a Beretta. My Ruger here has got a lot more grains to the bullet. Some of that goes on in the poor and the uneducated. I realize it still exists. One of the reasons why is, you know, here I live in Trump land. Because I'm old, people can talk freely around me.
Yeah, it's amazing the stuff that people will tell you because you're a white guy and they think that you're on the same page as them. Especially when I was working retail. You're at a place and you're trying to buy something and then you're going to go off on this racist screed about your sister shacking up with a person of color and blah, 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 and N-word this and N-word that. It's like, dude, I'm just trying to make a sale, man. I'm not here for this. But you sort of stand there. It's like, all right, this is the job. Part of the job is just listening. Seeing people go off, regardless of how you feel about them, you know, it's not my job to judge.
Well, you were a lot younger then. They thought you might be impressionable.
Maybe. I think some people are just.
And let's face it, you were. You know, that makes a big difference because that was the home of the East Texas KKK, that gun range we used to go to. That's one of the reasons why I quit going there, because I discovered that they were all KKK. That's why I like military spec. You notice I didn't mean move the gun. It was on its side and it loaded fine. You can't really do that with something that's not military spec. No telling how that bullet's going to try to feed. Okay, you want to try it on?
Sure.
All right, we'll go a go-go. But yeah, all that stuff, when I, you know, it doesn't keep me from reading these action books, you know. But it also, it tells me that most of the people that read them haven't lived through any of that. And to me, that's kind of comical. And he came around the corner. At the bottom of the stairs was this huge shadow. Big beefy hands holding on to something that looked like a half pitchfork. And he raised it and went to throw it. And that Beretta 93R came up and a couple of soft coughs and the brains went spraying. The light from the next room gave it an orange halo and a soft pink across the wall. And the girl, she had some stones, because she just stood there and looked. But how long that was going to last, who would know? And it's every time.
Right.
Every time, especially with him, everything was a headshot. And I noticed the Remo Williams, he likes to take guys' heads off too. But he also likes to pull whole arms off.
So we got anything left on the executioner stuff, or are we pretty well tapped it out?
You were talking about that.
I was just
that.
Curious about the team.
But see, that's just it. He still has some contacts. Sometimes he calls for extra help, but it's mostly information and that kind of stuff. And in the book, that book there, number 77, he's working with his little brother.
Yeah.
Apparently his little brother, grown man now, and he did a tour in Lebanon or something, so he's actually a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of working with Bolin on this deal out in Hollywood.
Yeah. So do they ever get the guy who was targeting them?
Yeah, he got them both. A lot of people, it's like we were talking about 007. In a way, 007 is a trilogy, and he actually did have several trilogies, like three book trilogies, in the books they used for the movies.
Yeah.
You know, but most people wouldn't know that because they only know the stories in the movies, and the movies leave all that extra shit out because they rewrite everything.
Yeah.
Sure, when you figure out a way to edit, you ought to add that clip right there. You ought to add into your lead in, find a spot, you redo your lead in, find a spot.
The Assize Spy, like anime freaks. Anime Nostalgia, Billy Hines, Canoes, Captain Entropy, Chris at Bat Books for Beginners, Chris Lydon, Christine Forster, Coffee and Comics, Dario Oliveira, Del Dracula, Derek W.C., Doc Strange, Gregory Litchfield, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe Was, The Irredeemable Shag, Kailish Jwala McKee, Writer and Media in Charge, Keith G. Baker, King Dinosaur, Lorenzo Sleestak, Lucretia Garcia, Office Barista, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Sploctopus, Siskoid, Speaker of the House Kirk Spencer, Thirsty's New and Used, and Resurrections, a Warlock and Thanos podcast.
So the bonding agents podcast, he gets up while his dad is talking to just go to the bathroom. And his dad doesn't understand because his dad thinks they're having a conversation out there recording a podcast. So he thinks he just gets up and walks off, kind of like snaps at him. He's like, oh, well, you know, I had to shit or whatever. And he was talking about how he's like, yeah, you know, it's like, he goes, I got no problem. And I got no problem shitting, but I got problem when I need to piss out my asshole. I'm like in the gym, listening to them yell at each other. Like, why the fuck are you leaving? So I got, because I had to piss out my asshole. I couldn't hold it. It was going to come out my asshole. Now, what about Dr. No?
That's how you lead into that question.
And then he starts talking about firearms and Delta Wing after talking about how he's about to shit his pants and he had to get up.
Yeah, but are you just...
It's like an almost 2 hour long podcast. It's fucking insane.
Two crazy people talking to each other?
Nobody can be listening to these podcasts. Nobody.
I think they use them in North Korea as a torture. Yeah.
they're doing it to design airplanes, probably. Secret!
The preceding program is intended for the common good at no expense to any citizen. It should therefore be considered to possess a license to thrill in service to fair use, and not seen as a hostile act against copyright owners in the international marketplace.
As always, should you or any member of your team be caught or killed, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.